Well, that was fascinating. Thank you. Before we start taking questions from the audience, I just want to quickly introduce our two expert panelists who are joining Mary. Colette Barron-Bradsby is an attorney with the Texas Parks and Wildlife Department and is quite an expert on environmental flows in Texas and has written a number of publications, among them most recently The Changing Face of Water Rights in Texas, 2007, for the State Bar of Texas. And she's written about the Texas Water Trust and other things as well. And then next to her is Patrick Shriver, who is a water resources planner for the San Antonio Water Systems. And Patrick is someone who has actually participated in the design and implementation of a reverse auction here in Texas for the Edwards Aquifer in 2003. And so he's actually been there and at least tried this once and is going to talk to us about that or is able to answer questions about how it's worked in at least one instance here in Texas. So we're open to questions. I can also sort of start out, but has someone got a question we want to ask the panelists? Okay. Well, I guess I'd like to, Mary, I'd like to ask you to, you mentioned some of the legal and regulatory barriers. I'd like to elaborate on that a little bit, just for the audience who may not follow all the intricacies of how TCEQ defines rights and why you have to go back to them and get it changed. So I'd like you to just elaborate on that a little bit.
Well, I'd love to have Colette jump in here.
Or Colette, either one of you.
And I know there's a lot of other water law experts out there, but the real question in Texas, the law on changing the place or purpose of use of a surface water right is, shall we say, in flux. It is in flux. There was a provision in 1997 in Senate Bill 1 that purported to say, according to some people who were involved in getting it in that law, that you could transfer your entire paper water right, no matter how much of it you had used, basically without a hearing or notice and hearing at TCEQ. There was a Supreme Court case, which, full disclosure, my husband was involved in, that questions that interpretation. Most Western states, you can only transfer your historical consumptive beneficial use, not your full paper right. So that in itself, at least if we're talking about permanent transfers through reverse auctions, is supremely complicated. And that's why I mentioned the idea of dry year auction leasing or forbearance, not really raising all those complex issues. But I don't know, Colette, you want to add to that?
I don't want to get into the long history of the problems with the amendment statute, but I do agree with Mary that there's not really a threat of cancellation. So the forbearance option could be very attractive. You're not really, you know, thinking that the TCEQ will knock on your door and try to take away your water right for non-use. Now, on the flip side, though, if you think about it, if you want this during a dry time where that water is needed in the stream, how do you protect that under this forbearance or lease option? You have a paper right that allows you the use of water for a particular purpose. So let's say it's an irrigation right. You haven't gone through the amendment process. You do not have a right for in-stream use protection or environmental flow protection. How are you going to preserve that during a time where there's competition for that water? As many of you may know, that we don't have segment-wide protection or even administration of water rights. So you have your water right at your diversion point, you know, for X amount, for X purpose. So if you forbear that, does that just mean that, you know, 50 yards downstream, the next person who has a right is going to pick that up for his purpose, irrigation, et cetera? If you don't have that in-stream use designation, I am worried you will not have the ability to make a call on that water to preserve it if you are in a position of seniority. For those of you who don't know, we are a first-in-time, first-in-right state for surface water law, for surface water. So the more senior rights get fulfilled first before the junior rights. So let's say there's a time of competition, it's the senior's right who is met first. So I'm a little bit worried about that situation coming up and not having full legal protection if you don't go through the process of amending that underlying right to add in-stream use. And as Mary said, the whole simplicity of that process is questioned now because of some litigation as to whether adding in-stream use is such a minor amendment that it doesn't have to go through notice and possibility for contested case procedures. And, you know, that could be a big barrier. Someone could say, you know, gee, I'd love to do this, but not if I'm going to have to go through the trouble of, this, you know, meeting this big regulatory hurdle. So I think it's actually an exciting time to be thinking about these things. And I do think that within the TCEQ's present authority, there might be a way to streamline that amendment process for, you know, certain types. And so it's a time for people to step out of their traditional roles about how things have been done and start looking at, well, how do we make it easier? Why are we talking about how difficult it is instead of, you know, maybe paths to make it easier? So I think there's a way to get over some of those existing regulatory hurdles.
Any questions stimulated by this? Okay, go ahead.
Yeah.
We've got a microphone to bring over here.
Most of your comments have been about periods of low flow. It seems that there's probably more opportunity, a little bit easier during periods of high flow to divert water from rivers when there is excess flow going down. Yet all of the processes going through TCEQ and the water master still exist during that period. How do you see, you know, kind of working on that side of it and trying to work with TCEQ to enable people to buy water rights and only, you know, kind of the more junior rights and get that water out during high flow periods?
Well, I think one of the practical problems with diversion of excess flows is where do you put it? You know, and so if you're trying to divert additional water that's normally not there, that's above, you know, the usual average year, then you've got a place to put it, and you have to store it, which is a big enterprise to create a reservoir, and then you have to be able to get that water to the place where it's needed during those times. Now, of course, you know, during wet years, we're not really worried that much about, you know, how to get water from here to there because there's plenty for all. So, for example, in the irrigation context, you know, farmers are getting water, you know, from the sky and not having to irrigate, and so more water stays in stream and we have, you know, greater benefits to the fish and wildlife and habitat that depend on it. So I think, you know, it involves a lot of engineering and thinking ahead to try to see a river as a system and how to manage it both in dry times and in wet times, how to make the best use of that resource. And that, I think, is we're learning a lot more about rivers as true systems and thinking about all the needs and all the benefits within a particular system. And even before SB 3 in 2007, we had Senate Bill 2 in 2001 that set out the Texas In-Stream Flow Program to go study all the basins in Texas and find out, you know, what are the needs and what are the demands and what is the appropriate, in-stream flow system that you need in each river basin. And so I think, like, we're getting that information to be able to manage rivers as a system, but I think we're not in a position where we can say, oh, yeah, here's what we can do. You know, here's how to arrange things so we, you know, we get the best benefit out of it. So, but I think that's, you know, that's where we're headed.
I'd like to just ask Patrick to speak briefly about the actual experience the Edwards Aquifer Authority had, San Antonio Water Systems had on conducting one of these.
And I didn't come here to make a plug, but aquifer storage and recovery, such as in Kerrville or San Antonio, is an option for storage. Okay, yeah, just our experience, it's not going to involve all the econometrics, and we were on the bleeding edge of technology. I'll say that this came about in 2003. SAWS had already been using kind of a subscriptive approach of, we had a price, we were going out there, getting to know the market. The permitting system was still also a little bit in flux, as the word was used. Edwards Water's been permitted twice now. There's a bunch of things that go along with Edwards permitting that's important, but we had a really good understanding of our playing field, and I think that's important to know in trying to run one of these. I will say I'm not a techie, so I wasn't like right on top of this and said, hey, let's do this. But we moved out of that subscriptive approach, and we were working in a kind of a hybrid. We looked at markets out in California, in Colorado, the Rio Grande. There have been markets running 70s, even early 1900s, if you know, go further west. So we looked at all those different models, and we were at a point where our planning kind of stagnated in some of our Edwards or low-hanging fruit, as you would look at it from our planning perspective. And so running this reverse auction was an option that was presented to us primarily by our procurement department, which is kind of strange. So we got together with them, and I think another important perspective that I can give just from this experience is, you know, you have to work with the right auctioneer or the right auctioneer house. We had a fixed price. You can obviously negotiate a fixed price to do your auction, or you can do it on a volumetric type basis. You know, they can charge some kind of brokerage fee or on the amount of water that goes through. Ours was it was a single bid, but it was a live bid on, you know, on the internet. It took a lot of work. We did this in a 3 to 4 month period, the planning and everything and getting it executed, which is phenomenal. But we went out. We actually gave barbecue. And we had sit-down meetings, and you know, we tried to be as transparent as we possibly could. We told folks we were interested in 10,000 acre feet of water. I don't know if that was the right number at the time. That's what we used. I will say, in kind of in the background, we had a large right of first refusal on a large sum of water also sitting there. So the reverse auction was kind of a pricing sensitivity gauge, but that's not really what we were using it for. We would have pulled the trigger on it if this other option that we had wasn't a better price for our customers. Our prices were broken up into 5 blocks. We actually were paying a premium on larger blocks of water. We were looking to procure up to 10,000 acre feet. We got 9 bids. We got 1,600 acre feet through the internet-based system. And in the end, our board and the decision of the company was not to pull the trigger. Gauge it a success or not, it was 1,600 acre feet of water at approximate price of $1,700 an acre foot. We were able to close a 9,000 acre foot deal at $1,675. So pure economics.
Okay, great. Thank you.
So that was actually the interesting thing about, well, a couple interesting things about that. One, it was a permanent acquisition.
Correct.
Which is, I think, one of the very few cases where reverse auctions for water have been used in terms of a permanent acquisition. And I thought the other thing was interesting is that you gave a premium for larger blocks of water. And I think that's something that a lot of these reverse auctions, if they're really going to be successful, and I think they saw that in the Deschutes, they actually had a lot of small water right holders in the basin they were looking at, and they excluded those that didn't have at least 10 acres worth of water rights because that was just too much and they couldn't deal with all those little transactions. So particularly when you've got a private trust that's trying to administer it, I like that idea of the premium for the larger blocks. There's other kinds of premiums that can be given, too, in terms of seniority of the right or where it's located on the stream or how easy it might be to add in stream use to it.
Yeah, our transactional costs were more for the lower block, so that was a big consideration.
Okay. Other questions? I think you had some there.
I guess I'm just a little confused about stream flow because my own experience is with SAWS a little bit is that we're pumping from an aquifer, and there's no stream flow requirement there. Now, we're not pumping from a river, and in Texas, surface water is state-controlled anyhow, so the nexus there, I'm a little bit uncertain as to what we're talking about, because we can lease water or we can purchase water rights, I should say, but what my familiarity is with aquifer water, and so how does that tie in with the flow requirement?
I think the nexus is just the tool. I mean, I was asked to come here and describe the tool, and I think they're, you know, kind of we've been going around, and I talked to Colette this morning. I mean, is this a viable thing in Texas? And you know, we may get some negative feedback on the surface water side, but there obviously are some options to use the tool and learn from the experience. I mean, we designed this auction without the help of the paper that was presented this morning by Ms. Kelly. So I went back and actually read a lot of correspondence. What's exciting is we had the right questions were being asked. We weren't all experts in auction, you know, design. But when I go back and look at it, we, you know, 80%, 90%, we did a pretty good job. We carried the auction through. My colleague described it as a success in the articles or the papers. There's some quotes there. And, you know, I think it was a success for the short run that we had.
But no criticism. Yeah, just, I know what you folks have done.
But just to answer your question, Larry, so it could be used in the surface water context alone in other places in the state, but the potential link, in fact, to surface flows is the way it could be used in the Edwards is to incentivize forbearance, which should then help preserve spring flow at Comal and San Marcos, right? So less, I mean, given all the complications of hydrogeology of the aquifer, but you might be able to do that in other small aquifers that discharge in springs that are an important part of the base flow of streams.
Yes, back there. Our
forbearance of the water show up, were there facilities that then had to go through, again, another economic and environmental analysis? Or do you see that coming?
I certainly, in what I know so far about reverse auctions in particular, they haven't been used in that situation. And I think partly it's because they're such a new tool and people are trying to figure it out. I thought it was fascinating when Pat said that it was their procurement department that suggested this, because they are used for lots of other kinds of transactions, kinds of procurement transactions, but they're so new to water that I think testing them where you don't have that added complication of building infrastructure or trans-basin diversions is probably what we'll see for a while. However, they are, you know, if they are done right, they are a super cost-efficient method of acquiring water, particularly the water rights area where you don't have a lot of public information about the value of water rights. And the value of water rights is both so site-specific and so non-transparent. I mean, I think that's one of the reasons people look to reverse auctions as a tool to deal with that lack of market information.
Yeah, and emotional.
Yeah, I mean, you'll still have some of the issues that, you know, there was obviously a lot of opposition in Imperial Irrigation District to the Met transaction because of taking water out of that community and the impacts on jobs. That doesn't go away with reverse auctions, but, you know, there might be a way for the buyer to set aside, you know, some money to deal with community concerns or something like that. But I don't think that's any different than any other ag to muni or ag to environment transaction.
Sue? Oh, sorry.
Here? Me? Okay. I was going to suggest that if you're looking at a parallel between surface water rights and groundwater, it would seem to me it would be the production permits that would be the premium that you'd be talking about. And I'm guessing that what might break things loose is when we are assigned managed available groundwater numbers, because that's going to cap things, I guess. We think. We don't know. We think. We'll find out after there's a lawsuit or two. But then it seems to me then that kind of opens up the possibility of doing this. Otherwise, it's sort of an unconstrained resource. You can't really put price on it if there's not a cap.
I mean, I think that is exactly the right point until, you know, the districts that are out there struggling with desired future conditions through the groundwater management areas and what the managed available groundwater is for the district, and we know whether that can and is going to hold up as a firm cap, it's probably not likely that this tool gets used. That's why the Edwards can do it. But, you know, I will say, looking out there in the future in Texas, this is probably a bit of a controversial remark, maybe we'll start some discussion. I mean, we just, Laura and I worked on a report where we kind of came to the conclusion that except for those small districts west of I-35 where there's a lot of them where there's not a lot of pressure on them, and they're small and they're working well and they're doing their good job. For some of our major aquifers in the state where there is a tremendous amount of pressure, and they're big aquifers like the Carrizo-Wilcox or the Northern Trinity, this district-by-district approach is not sustainable into the future. I mean, it's what we have now. Everybody's working with it. But at some point, we need to learn from the Edwards model, which has, despite all its fits and starts, has been, I think, particularly successful. I mean, there's data out there that shows that the Edwards legislation and regulations had not been in place, Comal and San Marcos would have gone dry, I don't know, 8 out of 10 years or something. I can't remember what the date is, but a significant number of years. That's not that many successes in the water world. You know, it's been hard to do, but the Edwards has been a success. And what can we learn in Texas from a regional approach? And like I said, give people an outlet that they can buy and sell defined groundwater rights, because if we don't have that outlet, the pressure is just to pump them all down and have big drawdowns and to litigate against these small districts that have no resources to defend themselves. That's my soapbox.
David?
As long as Tyson's here, I'll take advantage of a couple of questions. One, in the Georgia and Oregon examples, what was the source of funding for the auction? And then also, I know in Oregon, the water right systems, water right systems more conducive for providing water for the environment, whereas you're protecting a segment of stream versus just a point, as would be the case in Texas. I mean, you could get delivery to a point, but not beyond. I'm wondering if they were able to kind of surgically prescribe in Oregon when the water would be made available for those streams.
In terms of the sources of funding in Georgia, I think it was state money, either the legislative program and state general revenue. In the case of in Oregon and the Deschutes, it was actually they have a variety of funding, but I think the funding for this actually came specifically from the Columbia Basin Water Transactions Program. So it's a federal appropriation that it's managed through the National Fish and Wildlife Foundation, and they fund the shoot. So it was actually federal money, and they wrote a grant to go ahead and use that piece of the federal money like that. Oregon, I think, though we're catching up in Texas, does have some better provisions for protecting in-stream flows. I don't know, Colette, you want to address those?
I do think in Oregon they did have the ability to manage the water rights on a segment-by-segment basis, and it's almost like a closed system, and so you're able to provide that protection for the whole segment rather than just a point-by-point water right like we have in Texas. So what Mary talked about earlier about the scale of a reverse auction working or really any market mechanism to protect water for environmental flows, I do believe it has to be fairly local. Because you have to be able to see where are the, you know, competing water rights, what are the demands, and how to manage a particular area. And so I do think you'll have to spend, there should be a lot of investigation and diligence done before you can even target where you're going to get the benefit from a water right that's either leased or converted, you know, for in-stream use protection. But I think it's an exciting thing to come into Texas and to start looking at a viable market for the value of in-stream use, of environmental flows, because I like this idea about the sellers telling us what it means to them. The value question is very complex and extraordinary. You know, it goes back to the very fundamental relationship between the state and its natural resources. You know, the surface water is held in trust for the people by the state. And it gives out permits with permission to use the water, but it holds on to the ownership of the body. Now, when the state permitted this water, they didn't put a value on it and say, hey, and it's worth this much, you know, when you take this much acre feet and it's used, you know, for municipal use, et cetera. So the value has been associated with what use it was put to. And, of course, that could change, you know, in every locale. And have we thought about how we're going to value rights? If we're auctioning off irrigation rights, are they valued at the value for irrigation water? are they valued for the environmental services that they might provide when left in stream? How do you get at those values? So this is very complex, and you just think, well, gosh, there's so much involved. But if the sellers tell you what it's valued to them, my God, you've got a starting point, you know, and you have the market telling you the answer without years of complicated research about market like sales and, you know, this and that. So I think it'd be great for a pilot project in a defined area where you have some participants who have an incentive to get in there, and they can show how it works, and they can have ownership of the process and of the pricing. We don't have that. We don't have an active, open market for any kind of right, frankly, you know, in Texas, you know, except maybe the Rio Grande as a closed system. So I don't know if that was too rambling, but...
Let me ask you a question quickly, because, Mary, you mentioned something about the issue of trust between, you know, the sellers and the buyer in the transactions. And I wonder if you all would just talk a little bit about trust and transparency, and what are the sort of sideboards on that? I mean, what, you know, obviously, in a way, if you're the state or you're whoever's trying to buy it, you know, the less people know, the better. But what's the balance that we need to strike there?
My experience is trust goes both ways. And, you know, we've, you know, been, like I said, active in some way in the market since 98, you know, through the groundwater leasing, purchasing. The reverse auction in itself was used by a number of speculators and folks in the market to maybe try to take a stab at, you know, our trustworthiness because we didn't pull on the bids or didn't buy them. But, you know, unbeknownst kind of to the public, we don't have a, you know, bottomless pit of money. So the thing is we had to go in, and you have to rebuild trust, you know. If there are folks out there that, you know, basically want to, you know, cast some doubt or spells on your tools or your methods, you have to do some management of that. There was a lot of advertisement involved. There was a lot of one-on-one, and everything you read in the paper isn't always true. Like I said, we spent quite a bit of time with 700-plus permit holders. But we had the same issue, too, with people priced their water right up to our next water project, generally. You know, we did the agronomics on a lot of issues and approached folks that way, and we're even above the agronomics. But when you get speculators in your market, whether it's groundwater or surface water, that's going to really put something into your market.
You know, clearly the trust is absolute, the trust of the trust, but what the entity is, how transparent it has to be. I mean, I think Georgia was interesting in that they knew, the bidders knew what the total budget was, but they had no idea how much water the state really wanted to acquire. So they knew one piece of information, but they held back another. I think the example in the Deschutes of making sure that the irrigation district manager saw the reserve price and had it before the bids were open. And actually, the other detail of that Deschutes auction is they all came to the irrigation district office. They opened the bids in public. They had a certified public accountant there. They did everything they could to kind of build trust. There is a reference, and not something I got enough time to read about, to a reverse auction in the Yakima up in Washington that completely failed. They got no bids. And the organizers of that auction essentially blamed it on lack of trust of the farmers in the process. So I think it would be interesting to look a little bit deeper into that. I think in Texas, some water right holders are more likely to trust the state than, say, a private nonprofit water trust. But I think there's others where water right holders are more likely to trust their local government, their city, if their city wanted to buy water, or even have more faith in a local nonprofit that was composed of local residents on the board. And we've actually found in the Trans-Pecos Water Trust, you know, the property rights capital of Texas, which is really saying something, that we've been able to develop trust with water right holders because the board is largely composed of local ranchers and farmers who really know their fellow water right holders.
I also want to say in our experience, the computer-based portion of it can add to mistrust. Like I said, I'm not a techie, and having to go out, we had a proxy option so people could put in a single bid on the proxy, but on the internet-based system, they were actually bidding.
It's a tax. the microphones.
The folks were actually all pre-registered and were bidding under a number. So it was pretty unique in the fact that they could see those bids and those blocks kind of dropping. They knew we were going to take only 10,000 acre feet, which I said may not have been the right number with the amount of volume we got in the bid. But, you know, out there, there are folks also that don't want their neighbors to know maybe that they're participating. So on the internet, basically, it was at least anonymous until we actually sealed the deal, or we would have, you know, penned a contract 3 or 4 days afterwards, and then 30 days afterwards potentially closed. But that was an issue. You know, we talked to a lot of folks out there that didn't want everybody knowing that they came into some money.
Well, we are getting to lunchtime. If there's one burning question, we'll take it. Otherwise, anybody? Otherwise, let's thank our panelists. This was fascinating.